All right, back on for part two. You just missed some good stuff there. We're talking about ayahuasca and what's going on when you take drugs. Yes, if phenomenology had become the universal philosophy that Husserl imagined it to be, I think there would have been a whole branch of it that would have been looking into psychedelic drugs. And another branch would be looking...
I mean, they are, aren't they?
Yeah, but they're not phenomenologists. Yes.
So I'm told, I haven't read a lot about it.
Yes. Yeah, there are our friend.
Doses.
Yeah. Yes, it's regarded now as a kind of a possible therapy for depression.
Yeah, and because it helps you to change your perception.
Yeah.
And exactly that is why it could be potentially
useful. It breaks people's
structures. Yeah. It's better than electroshock therapy for resetting the brain.
Hope so.
Yeah.
Not with everyone.
If I'm saying anything, I'm saying that the question of what is the world, I'm not going to answer it. I'm going to say it's in itself not at all obvious. But one aspect that Husserl is pointing out there is that we're back into this sense of what's going on all the time, every moment. Is we're granting validity to things. We're saying this chair is actually here in the world. It's not a projection, it's not an illusion, and I'm not uncertain about it either. It's got this bodily presence, as Husserl calls it, which is different to the presence of, like last week we were talking about my car or something that you own that isn't here. It's got a kind of a presence in your world, but it's not bodily present, and there's a certain degree of uncertainty about its being. But it's only the stuff that's right in front of you now that has that quality of certainty attributed to it. And part of phenomenology is the recognition that this is going on all the time, that in one way or another, as you move through the world, you're continuously, from within yourself, granting validity to the things around you.
But we do it collectively, somehow.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
We all have to say the light is red when we come into the traffic lights. And we're all having to say the same horse won the race, otherwise we're going to be a bit of a mess.
Yes. And we're trained...
So we grant validity to it collectively.
Yes. And we're trained to do so, and we check almost out of the corner of our eye that everyone's agreeing with us, especially if we start seeing things that might not be there. You know, we become quite interested in whether other people are seeing it. You know, that there's a kind of a deep sense of that we're collectively experiencing the same thing here in the room. That's part of it. That's part of the meaning. When I say I'm granting validity to this chair, part of the meaning of it for me that's almost embedded in it is that, and you're seeing it too.
But we're seeing it completely differently than you.
Exactly. But I mean, so went into this. I'm going to get out of this first slide in great detail. How you're seeing it, John, is how I would see it if I were sitting there.
Yes, all right. Let's grow up. Let's grow up.
Yeah, just to see how Husserl starts to build this up. I could have actually been sitting in that chair 10 minutes ago. Do you know? You are like another me. You're separated in space. But there could be another me separated in time that was looking at that chair. Do you see? And I grant absolute validity to the earlier me. I don't think, the earlier me wasn't experiencing the room from another point of view, and that only the point of view I'm seeing now is really real. Do you see? We grant our earlier selves we grant validity to what our earlier selves were seeing in our memory. We grant a similar kind of validity to what you're seeing, because you're like me. You're another point of view. You're a co-present me that's seeing things from another place. But there are all these other co-present me's in the past that were seeing things from another place. So I can quite easily include you in this group of, in this community of co-perceivers. And that's all part of the meaning of the world for us. If I start seeing things that aren't there, and they're absolutely, you know, I can even touch them, and yet other people, you know, don't see it, then there'll be a new meaning. Oh, that's the stuff I see that you can't. And I better be careful about when I speak about it. Do you know, I mean, I don't know if you've seen River. It was a detective program on TV where there's a Scandinavian actor, really good actor, and his partner, you know, his sergeant, you know, the classic thing, she died, and yet throughout the whole series he was experiencing her as with him, and so were we, you know, watching the TV program, and it was quite a fascinating engagement with the validity phenomenologically that we so easily gave to that scenario of the dead partner being, you know, she'd be sitting in the back of the car, she was trying to solve the case with him. But it was done, if you haven't seen River, it might not be on Netflix, you might have to dig it out of you know, you might have to spend your money on a DVD. Well, I expect there's some kind of this. Objective science, too. The bit that he's pointing out here, which I haven't even got to, the meaning of that sentence, is that, you know, we can experience something as being an illusion. And we can say, oh my gosh, it wasn't there at all, or it's not as I was perceiving it. And there's a kind of you can kind of make a leap to say something like, oh, well, maybe everything's like that. Maybe I'm experiencing everything as an illusion. But we don't think that. Whenever we experience something as being an illusion, we experience it within the context of the world that is not an illusion. And anything that's illusory, it's illusory because it doesn't agree with the rest. And it's the rest, if you like, the world in the background that's defining what the illusion is, and it's that to which our illusory experience has to be readjusted, brought back into line, if you like. And like John was saying, although in relation to this, brought back into line with how the others see it too. So our experience of an illusion is always within the context of what is not an illusion. You know, we always have this base sense of the reality or the being of the world and the everyone in it together. That's our kind of ground. Objective science too asks, all the time Husserl now is trying to point to this ground, and he wants to call it the life world. And for him, the life world is there before we do any science. Even though science becomes part of it, it's science's place, objective science, is it's kind of laid on top of the life world. It's if we perform a scientific theory, we have to actually go to a laboratory and perform an experiment in the life world. And when there's a reading on the apparatus, we actually have to use our little human eyes, and we have to read it, and we have to write it down in the life world. And when I write my papers with my abstract ideas in, I actually have to write and publish, and you have to read all of that, all of it, every observation you make in the life world, and all of your activities that you perform as a scientist, you perform in the life world, But science is a kind of a certain kind of higher level understanding of what of all that means. But it doesn't. It emerges out of and refers back to the life world, not in a in our. And he's saying this is the reality, not the what the because the way that science tends to see it is that the reality is the substructed, idealized scientific mathematical model of things, and the what emerges out of that is our experience. Do you see that science's understanding puts it exactly the other way around? But he's saying that in a way, one of the things he's saying is, well, this is one of our problems. I mean, I remember one of my teachers from earlier in life said, being rational and being logical are different. Being logical involves putting first things first. And if you don't put first things first, all of your rationality is useless, even though you're rigidly deductive. To be properly logical, you have to see the order of things. And the order of things is life world first. If you do it the other way round, you head off. It's a simple little inversion, but you head off into a certain form of understanding that we have become lost in our modern world. And Husserl is always saying, no, the fact, the certainty is the life world. It's always already there. That's a Heideggerian term, the always already. Yes.
So you mentioned earlier about the pre-given world. Is the life world a sort of formalization of that?
Well, he means the same thing. It's not even a formalization. The pre-given world is the world that's given to us, out of which we then do our science. That's the right way round. That's the correct ordering of things.
You just made a really good sentence that I tried to write down, but I kind of lost it halfway through. Husserl says that the life world, the pre-given world, is
primary. It's where we start. It's from there. It's from out of that science emerges, and it emerges entirely. It's grounded entirely in experiences in the life world. And its results also entirely refer back to that world. So the science has a ground, and the ground is the life world. But science itself attempts to understand things as if they were the other way round. That the world that science describes, the mathematically abstracted, objective world that science describes, it thinks that that is the ground out of which experience emerges. And they can't both be right. Objective science, too, asks questions only on the ground of this world's existing in advance through pre-scientific life. Like all praxis meaning practice, meaning practical action. Objective science presupposes the being of this world, but it sets itself the task of transposing knowledge, which is imperfect and pre-scientific, in respect of scope and constancy, into perfect knowledge, in accord with an idea of a correlative, which is, to be sure, infinitely distant, i.e. of a world which in itself is fixed and determined, and of truths which are, I'll just say, ideally scientific, truths in themselves, and which predicatively interpret this world. To realise this in a systematic process in stages of perfection through a method which makes possible a constant advance, this is the task of, I should finish the sentence, of objective science. So objective science wants to take the kind of knowledge that we have of the world and make it perfect, which means transposing it into an absolutely unambiguous language. And that absolutely unambiguous language is the language of what we would call now predicative logic. But predicative logic now has the scope that it includes all of mathematics. So predicative logic can make statements like we make in English or German or Russian or Greek, but the meaning of the sentence is absolutely unambiguous. It moves natural language from being an imprecise, ambiguous thing into being something that's utterly precise. By utterly precise, that it means that all of the terms in the logical sentence refer to objectively identifiable entities and relations, and not to the kinds of things that we refer to in language, where people have to continually say, well, what do you mean by that? A predicatively logical language, finally, what you mean, and this is logical positivism, what you mean finally has to come down to something that you can point to and measure here. So you can only really speak of the physical world in that language. So it's another case where there would be no word in that language for the pure quality of blue. Just wouldn't show up. It would show up as in blue is, and then you go and you describe exactly the physical characteristics of that surface that reflects the blue, but you couldn't speak of blue, blueness itself. Do you see the entire object of rational science, which becomes predicative logic, is to come to an absolutely unambiguous description of all that there can be, all that is possible to know objectively. A marvellous, an absolutely incredible project, in a way. And that's what, that's the theory of everything in cosmology. That's what they're aiming at. But finally, a predicative statement that says, these are the original conditions of the start of the universe, and from these basic conditions, we can deduce with absolute logical certainty the evolution of the rest of the universe, and, and they love it, and its ultimate collapse or destruction, or whether it's going to go on forever. We can deduce all of that. Isn't that amazing? Like God. Do you see how it's like God? If you can do that with perfection, you're God. You see the entire, all of time. Do you know, if you get the equations right, then all of time is there. And that's, you watch your program, on TV, that's how they think. And here's the sun. It's becoming this gas giant. Look, it's just getting to just the edge of the Earth, because they're not saying I'm dreaming this. They're saying I've deduced this. I'm seeing all of time for you. Amazing. Amazing. I'd just like you to kind of pause and think, because I remember. Nicolette's reading the Red Book and Jung's going through some kind of deep experience of the unconscious, and he meets this archaic god, I forget his name now, striding across the earth.
From the east.
And Jung meets the god and explains explains about the sun. What the sun is.
It's a
mountain
or something like that.
And the god is just destroyed by that.
Why?
Because
the god is rational,
baby. Yes.
The god
is, because
the
god,
the way it's like the god. So reality is this way from west.
Mm-hmm.
This giant, but it's not, it's something else. great big giants. It
comes
from
the east.
East.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
And I think it's a sort of piece, it's sort of about, he's kind of like a hermit traveller, the man,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of going towards the east. And he comes, and the closer he gets to the rational,
mm-hmm.
he just, you know.
He's destroyed. He's destroyed by science, essentially.
Yeah,
it's
destroyed by science.
Yeah, it's a kind of
a
metaphor, yes.
But it's Jung went incredibly deep into this in his own in 1913, 1914. He went into this place almost a psychotic place in a way. And the Red Book is about what his experiences were.
Right.
And it was published only in 2009. So it wasn't. He didn't ask it to be published. He didn't necessarily want it to be published, and he didn't. Wasn't very clear about it, even though he had people edit it and different things like that in his time, in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, the state that was gave it away, but allowed it to be published.
Mm-hmm.
But you,
so it's what's
Nick,
the bottom.
We don't. I know.
Yeah, that's right.
But the gist of it is the god up there, you know, that's pulling the chariot of the sun.
Yeah.
Do you know that whole mythical understanding of the universe and how science has just destroyed it?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
But Jung's encountering the psychic presence of the gods that were behind that.
In a real way.
Yeah. That have now been utterly detached from our experience of the world, which is where we started in a way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the but do you picture here that what science is doing is it's creating a world of pure ideas, absolutely unambiguous, pure ideas, mathematical, logical concepts that are themselves timeless. You know, the laws of the universe, science is always proposing laws of the universe that are, when did they come into being? Well, they've always been there. And they rule. Where do they rule? If you think science is really physical, you have to say, well, where are the laws of the universe? What world do they live in? They live in a place we can't think of. They live in the same place as all of those ideal triangles. Do you know what? I mean, it's the Platonic world. Only science has forgotten. It's the world of the Platonic ideas. Science absolutely relies on a world of Platonic ideas for its understanding of things, but doesn't see them. Just because it sees through them. But what Husserl's trying to point out is, do you see what science is constructing? This perfectly logical, predicative, mathematical model of all that there is, it's up there in the minds, collectively instantiated in concepts that everyone agrees about, but it's a kind of a collective possession of the scientific community, this absolutely ideal, perfected understanding in mathematical terms of all that there is that we experience here. Do you see they've created another, in this Platonic, really Platonic realm, an entire mathematical representation of everything that there is. How extraordinary that is, and how that's now in a way a part of the world for us as well. Do you see? But it's still a part of the world for us. And the entire abstraction is an abstraction from what can only be known and manifest in the life world. It's a description of the life world if you observe it objectively. It's not a description of how it is to feel pain. But of course, everything that you might say like that, there will be a mathematical description up there of what it is to feel pain. Do you see? Everything has been translated from here to there. The mathematical description of pain is up there. It's called C fibers firing, exciting certain pain areas in the brain that opioids shut down. Do you know, it's all up there. If you feel love, yeah, okay. There's the hormones, you know. There's a whole, yeah, love. We've got that nailed. Here's love. Everything. It's all up there in this other ideal world where everything is absolutely related back to the objectivity of a perfecting vision of what is down here. The two worlds.
It's a little bit like art. So you've got a pencil on a piece of paper, which is the life world, and then the painting on it is the ideal world.
Yeah, but you don't proclaim it to be the true and
Yes. Yeah. So when you have a painting in front of you, it's presenting something quite different to an absolutely unambiguous mathematical.
Sure.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's doing something. It's opening up another dimension, if you like this ideal world of this ideal mathematical world. There's an ideal world of art as well, isn't there? But the thing about art is it got a direction of fit in another direction. It's almost that you conceive something in the ideal world and you try and bring it to be out here. But science takes what's out here and tries to convert it into something ideal. Yes? It's making a model up there of what is. Whereas if you art with art, you're not trying to make a model of what is. You're taking something that you've conceived in this ideal space and you're trying to make it manifest. So you're taking the ideal and manifesting the ideal. And what science is doing is it's taking what is and it's trying to create something ideal that corresponds to it. So its creativity is entirely inwardly. I mean, if you understand science this way, it becomes a kind of a curious activity, doesn't it? Not at all objective. Come on, John, here we go. When we inquire back into what Kant had taken for granted, there opens up an infinity of ever new phenomena belonging to a new dimension, coming to light only through consistent penetration into the meaning and validity implications of what was thus taken for granted. Let me carry on. These are purely subjective phenomena throughout, but not merely facts involving psychological processes of sense data. Rather, they are mental processes which as such exercise with essential necessity the function of constituting forms of meaning. Enjoying this? But they constitute them in each case out of mental material, which itself proves in turn, with essential necessity, to be mental form, i.e. to be constituted. No objective science, no psychology, no philosophy has ever made thematic and thereby actually discovered this realm of the subjective. Not even the Kantian philosophy, which sought, after all, to go back to the subjective conditions of the possibility of an objectively experientiable and knowable world. It is a realm of something subjective which is completely closed off within itself, existing in its own way, functioning in all experiencing, all thinking, all life, thus everywhere inseparably involved, yet has never been held in view, never grasped and understood.
All I can say, why the Germans?
No, but there's no easy way to say this in our language. Because
Absolutely.
Our language is not designed to say this. So give him a break. Cut herself some slack. You see, what he's saying is that, okay, we're with Hume. We've got this idea of the sensations passing by, like on this screen, like on the cave wall. And we can say a lot of stuff about how these sensations are connected to each other. Yes, and we can have a kind of a psychology of association, which is what Hume's was. He basically said the way that we form our ideas of the world is that we associate sensations together, and we associate them to form objects, and then we associate objects together in the form of events, and we get ideas of cause and effect, but all by association. Say even if that were true, what Hume was ignorant of, even then, having gone that far, was, well, what's doing the associating? What is it that is joining these sensations together and making them into an object? Hume kind of covered that over by saying, oh, we just associate them because they appear next to each other in time. To which you have to say, yeah, but you don't have, just because something's next, one thing appears after the other in time, doesn't mean you have to join them together, does it? You could carry on just experiencing them as just a totally disassociated stream of colour, or a totally disassociated stream of sound. You know, when you hear someone speaking a foreign language that you know nothing of, you can't find the words, you don't know the gaps. Yes? Yeah. You know, it's going up and down, but I don't know where the gaps are, I don't know where the sentence begins or ends, where the words are. It's experience could be like that, just a stream of incomprehensibility, but it's not, right? So even Hume had to rely on something which was called association. Association forms a meaning. And what Husserl's trying to indicate here is you can't give any kind of objective physical explanation to the formation of meaning. This is where science, this is the key blindness of science, but of all of us, that we don't see that what it is to make meaning, because that's what I'm. This is a meaning I'm giving to you now. You know, we were here last week, those of us who were here. Was trying to talk about the meaning of meaning using meaning. You know, it's that's why I'm saying cut him a break. He's trying to say that a kind of an account that says experience is made out of the association of sense data. It's trying to make it experience into something like physical stuff. It's trying to objectify it and say, here's experience, it's sense data. But what you're missing there is, no. You've just, yourself, once again, invisibly to yourself, created a meaning. You've got a meaning, you've got something that you're now saying, this is sense data. Right, that's a meaning that you've created. And now you've got another meaning called association. We're talking to Hume here, David Hume, he's quite interested. So, that's another meaning. And out of that, Hume was just forming meanings to explain experience, but he remained invisible of the meaning creating ability that is for Husserl transcendental subjectivity. It's a big word, but it's what he came up with. It's what he's handed down to us. He had to use some word or other. Because the meaning of transcendental, the meaning of subjectivity has to be transformed by our understanding of what he's talking about. So what he's trying to say is that something like this: everything that we experience here is a certain configuration of meaning, and something is doing that. Something is making, or is distinguishing one thing from another. Not just because we have to, I mean, in Kantian terms, we have to have the idea that there can be independent objects that are separate from each other in the first place. Where did we get that idea from? You can't get that idea from experience. The empiricists say, oh, we learn it from experience. But I want to take you back again to the cave wall. There's no separate objects in the stream of colour that you experience as vision. If you were to think of it in those terms. Of course, you never experience that stream of colour, because as soon as you look out of your eyes, everything's already divided up for you. And because everything's always already divided up for you, you just see the divided upness of the things of experience as already being there in front of you. You don't have any sense of anything having been done in order for it to have occurred. But when you start to think back on it, because this is what the empiricists did, they thought, oh yeah, yeah, we just have the stream of experience, and in there are the objects, and we just see them. They didn't see, well no, something had to happen in order for you to be able to see objects. To which they would advert back to childhood and say, well, you had to learn to. But no, you see, in a way, it's very confusing, but I'd like you to follow me on this. Yes, there had to be certain processes of discrimination occurring in your brain before you could recognise objects. But those processes of discrimination going on in your brain have no meaning in them. There's no meaning in the firing of the neurons that are learning to do the discrimination. Once they've learned to do the discrimination, then you experience that as there being objects, which is a pure meaning. Are you at all with me?
No. Yeah.
Yes, yes, no.
Oh, sorry. I'd like to be, but I'm not.
We're at the edge. I mean, I feel I'm at the edge of language. I am at the edge of language.
So if, for example, a young child goes out and sees a leaf, it's a leaf, but it has no meaning to that child. It just physically makes the image go into its brain, sort of. And it has no meaning until it gets a name. It has certain qualities. It might be used for medication and so on. And all of a sudden, this leaf is not just a visual image, but a thing that has meaning.
Well, now let's go back. If it's a child, I just want to go back.
Yeah.
Knowing it's a leaf comes quite a lot later. Knowing it's an object is something a bit deeper, which is a kind of a bodily, visceral knowledge that you know that it's separable from everything else. As in, you could pick it up.
Yeah.
You don't know it's a leaf, but you know it's picker-upable.
Yeah, it's a thing.
But you see, the fact that it's picker-upable is something that you know. At a certain,
instinctively,
somewhat. You could say instinctively.
Mm-hmm.
What Husserl's saying is that, well, that's a word, but what does that mean? There's a knowledge in you of what it is to pick something up, that's built into your there's a thing. Yes, and not only that, there's a knowledge of space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that in order to be picker-upable, There's a nothingness between us. Yes? You understand the being of a nothingness. You see, nobody could explain that to you. If you like, you feel it.
Yeah.
Yes? And you you feel that you are centered here in a body. Now, you see, you can't learn that. Maybe you'd prefer the word instinctual. You instinctively feel your embodiment, and you're being separate from the stuff around you.
An awareness, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm trying to put into language that feeling is a knowledge, but not like a knowledge, oh, it's a leaf.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even have any language in it. It precedes language. Yes?
So you just know it's a green something that is...
But they're still putting it into language. You kind of know that there are... that I'm an enduring presence. And that the leaf is an enduring thing. Now, knowing that something is an enduring thing is... you cannot... it's not like saying, well, here's the number two and here's the number two, and you add them together and they're four. There's a level of understanding in us that precedes all possibility of language, that is an understanding of what space is, what separation is, what it means for something to endure, that are all taken for granted in us and have to be present in it as potentialities in us before we can learn anything. Let me give you another example. You can't be taught what the quality of blue is.
Okay.
You can be you're taught that's a blue thing.
It has a name.
Yeah, that's a blue thing.
Yeah.
But is that a better way in?
Yeah.
The quality of blueness was not created. Nobody made it. It's already a kind of a potentiality that's available to anyone who can see.
Yeah.
Even though, in fact, we have different language for colours and we never really know what anyone else actually sees. Do you see that quality of blueness is already present as a capacity for us in order for us to be able to have any experience whatsoever? And but there are more refined, less tangible things that are already available to us in order for us to be able to have an experience that are, because you can point to blue and it's more, oh yeah, I got it. But if you go back from that, there's even more subtle meanings what's up and what's down. The feeling of there being weight, what it is to feel pulled down. We call it gravity, we don't know what to call it, you know, but the downness of down is because there's a certain quality to being pulled down that gives us the meaning of what it means to be upright, what it means to be lying. All of these you don't learn these. There's a whole you have to learn how to use the language, but the basic framework within which we live, the meanings within which we live, are already available to us. Kant, you see, recognized this, but thought of it differently to Husserl. He thought there were actual concepts or ideas that already had to be in place in order for us to be able to have an experience. Like the concept of something existing. Do you know when I say this thing is actually here, it actually exists?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we can learn is something like the difference between something actually existing and it's not being existing, it being an illusion, or it just being something I'm imagining that's possible. But the idea of what it is to exist and the idea of what it is to be possible are all ideas that have to be in place beforehand, and then you learn how to distinguish between what's actual and what's possible. But the notion of actuality, of being, already has to be in place before you can say, so that thing I'm imagining now is only possible. And that's actual. I've learned how to distinguish, but the actual, what it means for something to be, to endure in time and space, you can't teach that. Your sensory world is already being thrown into a spatio-temporal arena, if you like. But we don't see it because it's pre-given to us, but not only that, we understand ourselves as being a player within it. Yes? But that very understanding that I am a player within this world is a meaning that we attach to our being here. He's about to say there's another dimension to our being here. There's the plane dimension where all we see are the tables and the chairs and the things. And then there's this other dimension, the depth dimension, which says, but all of it only has meaning to us because there is a meaning-bestowing intelligence behind it. Now, we don't see the meaning-bestowing intelligence because we're just experiencing the very world that it's projecting. I know I'm focusing on you, but it's good to have someone who doesn't understand, because it kind of makes me try and say it in another.
And thank you. That makes sense. The penny is dropping.
It's in the slot. It's.
But you wanted to say something.
Yes.
That was ages ago.
Okay.
We've got answers then. Yeah.
So you see, it's all hidden in the language here. He wants to say that what we're talking about here are mental processes with mental material and mental form. He means this is the dimension within which transcendental subjectivity works. It constitutes meaning.
Okay.
It's the constitution of meaning forms. And the best way to see this is to be an objective scientist and say it's all a load of rubbish. When you experience anything, it's all going on in your brain, and I can show you exactly where. And I'd like you to envisage the scientist doing that and saying, "Yes, you're experiencing of this table and of the leaf. It's all here. You see this pattern of neurons. I've got my brain scanner. Every time there's the leaf. There's your experience of the table. There's your idea of being. Do you see? It's a little pattern of neurons firing there." You see that there's no meaning whatsoever in what's being shown. If you didn't know what it meant already, it would mean nothing to you, except you just go, "What? What do you mean that's a leaf?" Do you see there's something, if you like, if you're a pure scientist, something has to take all of that stuff going on in your brain and turn it into this.
So it's almost like the meaning is the context of something. So the leaf is just the leaf.
Well, no, the meaning is the something. The something is the meaning.
Okay.
The something is, it's not as if there's a meaning and then a something. It's all meaning, meaning, meaning.
Bloody
it's all meaning being meaning. It's there isn't any thing that the meaning is pointing to, that everything here is a pure meaning.
You said something about it's transcendental, and then there came a word, it's what adds this meaning, kind of.
Transcendental subjectivity.
Thank you. I'm sorry, guys.
It's fine.
No, no. But the thing here is, if anyone's not understanding this, it's not a matter of just kind of putting your head down and saying, all right, well, everyone else seems to be understanding it. Because quite often somebody might be thinking they're understanding it, but doesn't, or might just be lying. You know, so it's always helpful for me as well, because I don't want to go thinking, oh yeah, everyone's nodding, that's great, you know. It's because that's not what the point is here, right? It's not for me to talk to myself. Although, I don't. In a way, I quite enjoy hearing some of the things I say. You know, because I'm not sure. Sometimes, do you know, I reveal things to myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fascinating part of teaching. Anyway, yeah.
Can you say something?
Yes.
I feel like I understand what we're discussing, but there's a voice in my head just screaming and saying, surely there must be a way to create meaning from nothing. And I'm thinking about basically I can't escape a model of thinking of an unborn child in the womb.
Yeah.
Sense data coming in.
Yeah.
And even though it might be sort of really abstract associations being built, that from there we can extract meaning. And I know what we've discussed so far is that. That's sort of like kicking the can down the road, really, because in the brain of that child, what is exactly meaning? Because you can't point to it, and I get that. But is there some way of thinking about it, some sort of mindset you can do where you can sort of... Because what we're experiencing is quite complex. So meanings upon meanings upon meanings.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
Can we really reduce that? What's the simplest, what's the most reduced...
So I feel like attacking this from a slightly different direction and sort of saying something like this, which is I'm taking you into my own philosophical view, I think, really, in a way. Because you're thinking of the baby and the brain in the womb, yes? And the baby in the womb has a body and a brain that is not formed like ours, but it will be behaving in a certain way, you know, according to what's happening. And there'll be a certain activity there. And one way of understanding that activity is to say there's a certain form to it. Forget about the neurons firing individually, but if you look at the way that the neurons are firing together, they're sort of, if you like, like the sea goes up and down, but there's a wave. It's like the neurons are firing, but actually there's a certain form to the way the neurons are firing, and it's sort of an identifiable form. That form has a meaning, and the meaning of that form is the baby in the womb experience. Yeah, there's a kind of a meaning to a baby being in the womb, and the form of what's going on in the baby is like that. Now, and when you're born, and as you learn, then your very learning means that you can start to exhibit different forms in your brain. Yes, and as you learn to discriminate things, the form becomes more and more complex. But that's just a representation of the meaning that brain is almost manifesting. You see, so there isn't, you can't take the brain and say it means nothing. Yes, because until you as a child we actually have to learn to discriminate things, and as soon as we discriminate something, we get a new meaning. Yeah, new meanings. If this course is going well for you, then you're getting new meanings as we go, right? And stuff's happening in your brain. That something is extraordinary here, right? That as stuff happens in your brain, then there is meaning. Meaning appears. I mean, the thing here I picture is the most amazing thing is that But generally, our little brain forms are just going over forms that everyone has gone over and over and over, and you've probably gone over and over and over for, you know, hours and hours in your own life. But every now and then, a human brain gets into a brand new form. And when you get in a brand new form, in some sense, whatever you call it, transcendental subjectivity has to produce in that moment a meaning in the universe that's never been seen before. Yes? But it's, do you see the sun? This isn't true, it's a model. Because in effect, I've divided things up and said there's a brain here and there's consciousness there, which is our kind of fate in this world to think that way. Because it's not really, I don't think we can really say that it's true that there's a separation. But if there is a separation, a picture like that is designed to give you the sense of there's something extraordinary going on that, if you like, can read the brain and turn it into this experience. And that, if you like, that's transcendental subjectivity. And it's an open intelligence. Do you see? Whatever the brain manifests, that intelligence has to produce something here. I mean, for us, most of our sensory stuff, we don't get any surprises, but we can get some surprises in terms of having a new idea or seeing a new connection, can't we? Are you getting a sense of that there's something going on here every second that's manifesting the world?
So I guess, in a way, if things were just purely objective, then something like an idea wouldn't come. So if everything was just logic and rigid, it needs something else to go beyond that to make an idea happen?
Well, you know, if everything was purely objective in the way that science sees it,
yeah,
there'd be no experience at all.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, there'd be no science. You see, because science is using transcendental subjectivity to give meaning to what it thinks.
Okay.
Do you see that science itself is a meaning configuration?
Yeah.
It thinks it's seeing things as they really are, but it doesn't see that's a certain kind of meaning configuration.
Mm-hmm.
It's not false because of that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have electricity coming through the plug, right? It's not false, but it's unconscious of what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we've got tons of time, 20 minutes. In the end, it is not the teleological unifying meaning running through all attempted systems in the whole history of philosophy. In the end, is not, is a question. Let me start again. In the end, is not the teleological unifying meaning running through all attempted systems in the whole history of philosophy that of achieving a breakthrough for the insight that science is only possible at all as universal philosophy? And did this not imply that they all repose upon one single ground to be investigated scientifically in advance of all the others? And can this ground be any other than that of the anonymous subjectivity that we've just been speaking of here? But one can realise this only when one finally inquires into that which is taken for granted, which is presupposed by all thinking, all activity of life, when one becomes aware of the inviolable unity of the complex of meaning and validity running through all mental accomplishments. Is this making sense now, thanks to what I've just been saying? Every second of experience, we are granting meaning and unity to everything that we're seeing and understanding. Maybe if meaning is a hard word, validity It's a table, right? I'm granting it. Do you see it? It's a computer. I'm granting it the validity of being that. It looks to me like I just see it, right? That it's already done. But we're going back. Yeah, it's already done, but something did it. Something is doing the granting every moment, saying, yeah, that's real, that's real, that's real. Ah, that's just a hazy image in the clouds. It's not really real. It looks like a face. Yeah, all of that's going, shh, giving it to us, giving us this field of meaning every moment. And then I look up into my ideas of philosophy. You see, I just, boom, seamlessly. It's amazing, isn't it? You're looking into the meaning of what I'm saying while looking at me. But the sheer ability, we understand, oh, that's an idea. We understand there's a mental realm and then there's a realm of actual experience. It's all being formed. This applies, first of all, to all the mental accomplishments which we as human beings carry out in the world, as individual, personal, or cultural accomplishments. Before all such accomplishments, there has always already been a universal accomplishment presupposed by all human praxis and all pre-scientific and scientific life. The latter have the spiritual acquisitions of this universal accomplishment as their constant substratum, and all of their own acquisitions are destined to flow into it, which is another way saying spiritual acquisitions. Remember, well, now we've got Recha here. It's Geist we're talking of, which means it's mind and spirit, isn't it? It's to do with German. Nobody quite knows how to translate Geist.
And that's the beauty of it, because it is, you can't fully describe Geist, essence of that, what it is.
Yes,
yeah.
But we always end up in a mess here because we don't want to say it's a mental acquisition, because Geist means more than that, but it also means the mental, whereas for us spirit means up in the sky somewhere, whereas German Geist, as I understand it, is a kind of a it kind of stretches between the two. It heads towards the spirit, but it includes the mental in it as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess it does, yeah. It is not external there. It's a human thing, but it is beyond. Yeah.
I mean, it's almost. I mean, this is where you see. I feel like the word Geist is almost pointing to something in the German mind, because it's the German mind that thought up transcendental subjectivity, and I feel like saying, so you of all people. Should get a hint of this.
It's funny though,
yes.
Isn't it? Because we Germans are not necessarily known to be like that, and yes, it is a thing that is ours, is culturally ours. But for example, you could describe somebody as geistreich, and that would mean that they are rich of this, whatever it is, and that could be somebody would speak very intellectually. But they don't have geists. Somebody would speak really airy-fairily, and they don't have geists. There's something that it's a spark almost.
It's a spark.
A spark that enriches something.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, I think you'd have to say that somewhere in Husserl there is Geist in what he's indicating here. I mean, because he's saying the spiritual acquisitions, what he actually means by this is the acquisition not of science. He's saying science relies on the spiritual acquisitions of the life world, which is just our having made sense of things like tables and chairs, but more than that, governments and buses. I mean, there's all of those cultural money. We understand what money is, but money is what's money? It's a cultural. I mean, money is a. I was going to avoid talking about money because money is a very interesting meeting place of the ideal mathematical world and the life world. Because the idea of money is that we can put a number to all of the things that exist in the world. I mean, this is where phenomenologists that I'm aware of haven't spoken about money. I was just bumping into this the other day. It's our quantification of, and we're all engaged in it, right? It took thousands of years for us to be able to say that this is worth £503. And then for me to say that that's worth £12. And that in some way, a certain number of them is the same as that. Do you know that we've got a kind of a numeric, ideal numeric measure that's become utterly ideal now? It's just digits in a computer, right? We don't even have gold anymore. We don't even have, I gave my bank notes to the bank and they put it in a vault. No, it's not like that, right? It's in the ideal realm where the rest of science lives. Just to get it, nail it down, that's where your bank account lives. And then whenever we engage in a transaction, we travel up through the ideal realm and back into the world again. Mm-hmm. When we use money, without a second thought. But there you go. There's one of the spiritual acquisitions of the life world, if you like. And he's just saying that the entire world of science utterly takes all that for granted, and moreover doesn't even look at it, doesn't even consider it worthy of study. We shall come to understand that the world, which constantly exists for us through the flowing alteration of manners of givenness, what a lovely phrase. That's, what Hume bumped into? It's the flowing alteration of manners of givenness. That's another way of describing experience, which gives it that flavour of the flowing alteration of manners of givenness. Do you see it? Husserl sees the stream of meaning that is experience. Is a universal mental acquisition, having developed as such and at the same time continuing to develop as the unity of a mental configuration, as a meaning construct, as the construct of a universal, ultimately functioning subjectivity. It belongs essentially to this world-constituting accomplishment that subjectivity, big idea coming, objectifies itself as human subjectivity, as an element of the world. All objective consideration of the world is consideration of the exterior and grasps only externals, objective entities. The radical consideration of the world is the systematic and purely internal consideration of the subjectivity which expresses or externalizes itself in the exterior. So, part of our meaning configuration of the being of the world is that the very subjectivity that we are, out of which the world and everything that we know is emerging, we objectify ourselves as well. We see ourselves, we make ourselves into a being that's appearing within the very world that we're manifesting. And we take our intelligence, if you like, and we identify with the one who is externalized in the world. Even if we say, even though we're uniquely externalized as a body, and we see ourselves as, I'm not just an object like a cup, I'm the one who's in charge of this body, who's acting, who's moving my hands now, but I have become, in this extraordinary way, the entire world is manifesting out of me, out of nothing, right? Out of this dimensionless point. My entire experience is manifesting out of that. And in certain sense, Husserl wants to say, and really, I am that dimension, this point out of which it's all coming. But part of that is that I objectify myself as an actual player within the world, with a body out of which I see, of which I am the egoic centre, and I move this body, and I through my movement of the body, the world becomes manifest to me. If you see the distinction there, you'll see that that's where earlier on I was saying, for instance, Descartes didn't see that. You know, when he said, I am, I exist, he didn't get back to the very point that I am, I exist, as what? As that which manifests everything. He slipped up. He said, as the soul that's connected to this body. I'm the soul connected to this body. So he slipped up because he took the body to be the reality. And then his consciousness that manifests the body becomes an appendage of the body. And the same for Kant. And the same for nearly everybody who philosophizes today, right? To sort of say that that you're not your body now is considered to be something not modern. You know, it's a sort of a... Because it actually what happened is in the history, intellectual history of Europe, is that for a long time, intellectuals considered themselves to be inhabiting this Platonic realm and to not have a body. Yes, in a way, to just be, I'm just up in my head, in my mind, and my body is over here, and I've virtually forgotten about it. And certainly when I think, I don't have a body. And somewhere in the 20th century, intellectuals suddenly realised, oh, but I do have a body. You know, and everything that I do is centred on this body. And therefore, anyone who sort of suggests something like this is going back to that old intellectualism. So often Husserl is understood as saying, as not having realised that we are embodied. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying, yeah, exactly, that's exactly how we objectify ourselves. We exactly objectify ourselves as an embodied being.
In the counselling that I study psychosynthesis, there we have an exercise which is, I have a body, but I'm not my body. I have a mind, but I'm not my mind. I have feelings, but I'm not my feelings. So it's like kind of this idea that you, that is all you, but that's not all of you. So I don't know, it's like kind of, that you have these aspects and that there are you, but they are not, that's not all you are. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense.
Yeah.
But I say back to you, do you see that this, what Husserl is saying here, is not a model like that? He's saying, no, this is how, if you look into how it actually is, there is such a power that is manifesting all of experience, and it does objectify you as an embodied being within that experience, and that's how it is. It's not a theory, it's not a model. This is the structure of how it actually is for us. I mean, a lot, if not most people, gag on transcendental subjectivity because it points to something that they say, well, I can't possibly experience transcendental subjectivity. I can't possibly be it because I am this embodied being. Do you see? The whole thing of... phenomenology, essentially, is to say, well, no, there is the possibility, and that's what the phenomenological reduction is, of actually withdrawing, in some sense, and being at one, if you like, with this place of transcendental subjectivity, which is a place of pure or sheer witnessing. Now, this is where it becomes part two. Right? This is part two. We're scuttering around it in a way, but we're saying no. This is not a theory. It's saying no. This is what Searle is going on about. Is he's saying this is something that you can discover by looking into how it actually is. And what you are saying about I am a body but I'm not my body is an expression of that, but that's lacking an absolutely grounding knowledge. It's more of a feeling. It's more there's a certain level where I am my body but I'm not my body because I can abstractly think about it. Now, the phenomenological reduction is not an abstract thinking about. Because your abstract thinking about is, that's what science does. It's a moving into an ideal world.
But now we're talking about the unthinkable, and nothingness is the unthinkable. So if we come out of nothingness, how can we possibly be thinking about it? Because you know, the minute I start thinking about it, I see these tiny.
So I'm going to go click, click, click. That is a question that has exercised me, and I have an answer, but not one that I can possibly go into until the second half of the course. But I exactly what you're saying is if you withdraw utterly back into this original place, you can't think. Right? So as soon as you think, you've left it. So how on earth can you speak of it? There's nothing you can do with it. It's a kind of a place of nothingness. But it's clearly, Husserl has an awful lot to say about it. So how is that possible? And I think one level of Husserlian philosophy is that he hasn't answered that question. I don't think he even... That's not to say that it's. I don't think he went into it.
But what I was thinking about, mindfulness and meditation, they use sort of visualization. And again, as soon as I start visualizing,
I get
it out of that state.
Visualization.
Yeah.
Is.
Because it's completely different.
Yes. It ain't what we're talking about here. Because visualization is imagination, is a creation,
and we're
not here to create something, we're not here to imagine something, we're not here to believe something. Right. We're here to observe what is. How do you observe what is? That's the that is the absolutely key center of phenomenology.
Do that again.
How to observe what is.
Sensations.
I'm not going to answer. I'm not going to answer. I've got 3 minutes and 3 slides. So we're going to get. I'm not going to go through these slides ever again. So let's just check. There's something. There might be something crucial in here. Kant's error. Kant's error is that I'm not even going to read this. I'll tell you in a few brief sentences. Kant's error is that he saw the problem. He saw that transcendental subjectivity, which is forming experience, can't be the action of a little personal psychological being in the world. So the way he saw it is that it can't be this. I mean, what we've just said, this being that, right, transcendental subjectivity. Externalizes or objectifies itself as this psychological being with its psychological experience, with its little consciousness of the world and the big world all around it. That whole thing, it can't be that is manifesting the whole world. You see it logically, not possible. You can't simultaneously be some entity within the world and manifest the world. It just makes no sense. And Kant was aware of that, so he thought, well, it can't be the action of human subjectivity that's doing the manifestation. It must be that there's something like transcendental concepts, that our experience is formed on the basis of transcendental concepts that aren't anything that we can ever know ourselves. All that we can do is we can infer or reason that there are such concepts on the basis of what our experience is like. So Kant places us in the world and says, are the worldly beings such as we are? We can reason. Our reason can get us so far, and it can get us back to the fact that there must be a transcendental subjectivity, if you like. But he didn't see it that way. He saw it as there must be these concepts that are structuring or forming our experience, and I'm going to list them now, what I think they must be. And almost everyone agrees that he got it wrong. He got his list wrong. He got what space and time is wrong. And so we can sort of say, oh, he was wrong. Get rid of him. But do you get the idea? He saw the problem. He saw that what Hume thought was that we're just isolated in our little self in the world, watching a cave on the wall. Kant said, no. Even to think like that, to associate things, dear Hume, there has to be some kind of transcendental concepts that are structuring your experience. What Husserl's going to come along and say is, yes, Kant, you're right, but you can work your way back to them. You can work your way back to these transcendental concepts because they're the transcendental understanding of a transcendental subjectivity that I actually am. So that's where he differs from Kant. The plane beings, Helmholtz had this image of the plane beings that in fact, if we're not aware of transcendental subjectivity, we're just looking at the plane. And there's everything that we experience is laid out, if you like, on this two-dimensional plane, and we're unaware that there's a third dimension. And this is a very common... It took Husserl to point out to me that it was Helmholtz that saw this, because loads of people use this image. Ouspensky did, in terms of there being a fifth dimension. Because at the moment we would think, well, we've got three dimensions of space, one dimension of time, but we are the fifth dimension, which would be the depth dimension for us. But it all came from Helmholtz's saying, all right, our entire experience is laid out in front of us as just the experience that it is. And what Husserl is saying, Helmholtz didn't see this, but he did see that what our brains are doing is inferring the causes of experience. That was Helmholtz's great insight. Husserl is saying we don't see the power that is granting the meaning that our experience has. And this depth dimension is the field of phenomenology. This is what we have to investigate. We have to investigate that which is granting meaning to our experience. Otherwise, our science, which is a plane, which appears on the plane, remains utterly incomprehensible to us. It just exists in this ideal world, utterly disconnected from our subjectivity.
It seems lifeless without.
Yes, because it's literally its connection to our immediate conscious living life has been severed, and yet it's our. You know, I mean, I like to go on like this. And yet, here we are. What are we going to do about global warming? Science. More science. That's what we need. More science. Listen to the scientists. Do you know, they'll save us. Coming next, right, we're at the final slide. Who could believe it? The life world was always there for mankind before science, just as it continues its manner of being in the epoch of science. Thus one can put forward by itself the problem of the manner of being of the life world. One can place oneself completely on the ground of this straightforwardly intuited world, putting out of play all objective scientific opinions and cognitions in order to consider generally what kind of scientific tasks, i.e. tasks to be resolved with universal validity. So he wants to study this, and he's looking at this, he's looking scientifically, but in quotes, because he wants to see what's universally valid about this domain, arise in respect of this world's own manner of being. Might this not yet yield a vast theme for study? Is it not the case that in the end, through what first appears as a special subject in the theory of science, this third dimension, this depth dimension, is destined in advance to engulf the whole subject matter of objective science, as well as all other subject matters on the plane? What imposes itself here and must be considered before everything else is the correct comprehension of the essence of the life world and the method of a scientific, in quotes, treatment appropriate to it, from which objective scientific treatment, however, is excluded. In other words, he's just saying, okay, you've got the picture, you've got the, there is something like transcendental subjectivity, but we've no idea how to approach it. And he's almost saying, you know, it's like an exciting novel. So read on. Okay, that's going to be part two.